roads, and I think the day in Northern Ireland will bring sunny spells and a few heavy showers. And the top temperatures on Saturday across the UK, mildest in Plymouth, 9 degrees, 5 in Aberdeen, but where it snows, barely above freezing. And the outlook for Sunday, little change. And guess what? Next week, whether you like it or not, probably not, it's turning colder again. Steve, back to you.
Colder?
Yes.
Than this? It's yes. Like you've taken a bit of every weather and chucked it in there for the next few days.
Right.
Thank you very much, Thomas. I'll speak to you soon. Okay, this is BBC Radio 4, and now we continue The Last Days of Detroit by Mark Benelli.
The frontier's endless horizon has always proved attractive to those with the facility for conjuring utopian mirages. The logical conclusion to such thinking is something I like to call the dystopian happy ending. You've seen this one before. After humankind finds itself close to eradicated by, well, take your pick, lab-produced plague, doomsday weapon, supercomputer, band of highly intelligent apes, the hardy survivors manage to come together and restart civilization, only this time we learn from our ruinous missteps and finally get it right. In this vein, the waning of the auto industry might create short-term pain for out-of-work employees, but why mourn the end of Detroit's hideously polluting industrial history? The sharp cultural critic Rebecca Solnit famously embraced this view in a Harper's essay titled Detroit Arcadia. To Solnit, the most extreme and long-term hope offered by Detroit is that we can reclaim what we paved over and poisoned, that nature will not punish us, that it will welcome us home. The local hub of such neighborhood-level leftist utopianism has long been the Boggs Center for Social Progress, headed by Grace Lee Boggs. After graduating from Yale with a philosophy degree, Boggs, who is Chinese-American, became involved in the civil rights movement. In 1953, she married James Boggs, a Detroit auto worker and labor activist. And for the next 40 years, until James Boggs' death in 1993, the couple agitated together for radical social change. Though enfeebled by age, Grace Lee Boggs has rallied to the moment. She contends that Detroit's collapse is an opportunity to foster a whole new way of looking at life in the future. One morning, I met up with a group from the Boggs Center who were taking a driving tour of Detroit, meant to showcase the sorts of granular DIY projects applauded by Grace Boggs. The tour was conducted by Rich Feldman, an avuncular, genially distracted Brooklynite who'd moved to the area in the late 1960s to attend the University of Michigan and then stuck around to work as a community and labor activist. I met the group in front of the ruins of the old Packard automotive plant. Feldman suggested that I leave my car on a nearby residential street, so I followed him down a leafy block, parking in front of a run-down home. There were no signs of any people. Abandoning my rental car struck me as a potentially irresponsible act, but Feldman seemed to think it would be fine, so I reluctantly climbed into his ride, remaining vaguely preoccupied for the duration of the tour with the certitude that my vehicle was being vandalized or stolen. Feldman, a scattered but entertaining tour guide, wore a padded blue union vest and spoke with a slight Brooklyn inflection. I knew that he'd begun working at the Ford Rouge plant after graduation as a political act, in hopes of spreading a radical doctrine to the working class. "I was there because I thought we could make a revolution," Feldman told me earlier. "I came in romanticizing what workers would be like, but the old-timers from the South all hated me. The plant was where people got their paycheck." We drove by General Motors Assembly Plant, one of the few auto factories still operating within Detroit city limits. Then we stopped by a 24-lot farm operated by a Capuchin monastery. They also raised bees and made their own honey. After that, we made our way to perhaps the most visible and enduring symbol of Detroit's DIY positivity, the Heidelberg Project. The artist, Tyree Guyton's beloved outdoor installation, which had spread over several residential blocks surrounding the house on Heidelberg Street where he'd grown up. In the 80s, as Guyton watched his neighborhood violently rended by poverty and the drug trade, he began painting bright polka dots on vacant houses on the block. He also decorated the sidewalks with totemic faces and erected plywood sculptures of taxicabs and empty lots and covered an entire two-story home with stuffed animals and built all manner of other sculptural pieces. The city government loathed the Heidelberg Project for many years. Two different mayors, Young and Archer, ordered sections of the artwork demolished. But since then, everyone has pretty much left Guyton alone. In many ways, the Heidelberg Project is the ultimate manifestation of a Boggsian vision of Detroit's future. A working-class African-American artist, through a stubborn, solitary act of imagination, crafting a better world out of his blighted surroundings. Heidelberg Street, once left for dead, has become a regular stop for tourists from all over the world. Just as we parked, Guyton himself, who no longer lived on the block, happened to be pulling up in his Ford pickup truck. Feldman knew Guyton, and they greeted each other warmly. He'd come by to check on a flag he draped around one of the Heidelberg houses. The flag was so oversized, you only saw its stripes if you looked at the house head-on. It was a windy morning, and the flag billowed dramatically. We paused in front of a polka-dot-covered house. Guyton told us he'd grown up there. He said he could remember sitting on this very porch as a kid and listening to his grandfather tell stories about the lynchings he'd witnessed during his own boyhood in the South. Guyton had asked his grandfather, "But what exactly did you see?" And his grandfather had said, "I saw the soles of their feet blown in the wind." These stories inspired Guyton to decorate the great oak tree in front of the house with dangling pairs of shoes. Hundreds of them. Guyton said when people who'd visited the Heidelberg Project died, sometimes the families would bring a pair of the dead person's shoes to Guyton and ask him to add the shoes to the tree. Guyton had just returned from a show in Berlin. He talked about wanting to unite all peoples, and how, when he first started the project, his neighbors despised it. Some of them didn't appreciate the fact that it was bringing white visitors to the block. Then he said, "I know you guys are in a hurry, but let me ask you," and he gestured toward the sky, "do you believe in a divine creator who made everything?" Earlier, he'd made reference to a creator's having put him here for a purpose, but no one had said anything. We all shifted around uncomfortably. I muttered something unsatisfying about being a non-practicing Catholic. Feldman said he was into the cultural traditions of Judaism, but not the idea of a divine being looking over us. When we got back to my car, everything was fine. I'd worried all morning for nothing. A few blocks earlier, a pheasant had dashed in front of our path. We seemed to all cry out at once, delighted. One so inclined might have interpreted the moment as auguring something good. The writers, the builders, the hydroponic farmers, we all came to see the future. But 3 years later, none of us could say which version of the city would win the day. But as the recession ground on, I noticed a fascinating reversal of fortune taking place. Americans, it turned out, wanted uplifting stories. It didn't make rational sense, I knew, but I found myself edging over to the side of the optimists. I couldn't say why. It happened gradually. Even bad news contained some reason for optimism. The Detroit public school system had been making national newscasts since Roy Roberts, a former vice president at General Motors, had been appointed to replace Bob as emergency manager. His variation on Bob's efforts to privatize a number of Detroit schools was sounding like a public sector version of the auto bailout, in which the most toxic, irredeemable portions of the respective companies were split off into their own separate holdings, effectively quarantined. More immediately distressing, one of the schools slated for closing in the fall of 2011 was the Katherine Ferguson Academy for Pregnant Teenagers and Mothers. Several students, including Tiffany Baldwin, had been arrested after refusing to leave the school during a sit-in protest, and the image of pregnant black teenagers being led away by cops while handcuffed was replayed endlessly on the Rachel Maddow Show. A final rally was scheduled to take place on the front lawn of the school on the last day of class. But then, that very morning, as activists gathered in the street facing the school, a dramatic reversal occurred. Roberts, apparently sensing the public relations disaster on his hands, announced that Katherine Fergus Academy would remain open as a charter school with its current curriculum and administration, including Principal Andrews, intact. Detroit hadn't been treated to many happy endings as unqualified as this one. Not in recent memory. The rally still took place, but it went from being an angry wake to a raucous celebration. I ran into Tiffany. Her hair looked wilder than before, and she was furiously snapping photos for a website. She told me she was going to Henry Ford Community College, taking her prereqs for a physical therapy major. She said, "When I heard the news this morning and it was official," and then instead of finishing her sentence, she touched her heart. Not long after that, I found myself on the rooftop of a Detroit apartment complex, gazing over downtown, recalling the wintry afternoon when I'd scaled the crumbling Metropolitan Building. Now, though, I looked upon signs of positive momentum. Detroit loyalist Dan Gilbert had been purchasing a number of long-vacant buildings, including the Madison Theater, nearby, the 34-story Broderick Tower, vacant since the mid-80s, was finally in the process of being renovated. Another group of investors had picked up the GAR building, the castle with the boarded-up turrets originally built for Union veterans of the Civil War. Even Service Street was changing. The building next door to mine, uninhabited the entire time I'd lived there, had been purchased by a Brooklyn artist. Of course, it would be easy to end this book on a different note. Any number of the city's grisly headlines could be plucked and highlighted, and not unrepresentatively either. The truth is, my optimism was proving tenacious. I couldn't say why. And even when it faltered, all I had to do was turn to the bulging Detroit section of my bookshelf and pluck out something old. Say, All About Detroit, a handbook to the city written in 1899 by the historian Silas Farmer. Once upon a time, I would have thrilled at the cheap ironies therein, especially in the endlessly quotable section Farmer titled Dictionary of Detroit. The very first entry, Advantages, reads in full. Because of our location on the Detroit River, our advantages are many and exceptional. I could go on, almost at random. Homes, attractive, are very numerous in all parts of Detroit. Air and atmosphere, our skies are as fair as those of Italy. But something changed in me, somewhere along the way, and Farmer's sentiments no longer felt worthy of mockery. All About Detroit had been published 2 full years before Henry Ford scraped together enough capital to start the Ford Motor Company. Yet Farmer had already been indulging his readers with bigger dreams. He'd engaged in a touching and prescient leap of faith, one that had paid out far beyond any odds he or his contemporaries might have ever thought to set. So, who knows? Why not again?
The Last Days of Detroit by Mark Benelli was abridged by Pete Nichols and read by John Schwab. The producer was Karen Rose, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4. Getting ready for bed? Can I tempt you to stay awake for the shipping bulletin? Thank you. This is BBC Radio 4. And now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Saturday the 16th of March. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, Dogger, Fisher, German Bight, Humber, Thames, Dover, Wight, Portland, Plymouth, Biscay, Fitzroy, Sole, Shannon, Rockall, Malin, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800, low, Rockall 989, expected Wales 991 by 1800 Saturday, new low expected Cromarty 989 by same time. Low, Bailey 989, losing its identity. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours, Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira 40s, southeasterly 5 to 7, occasionally gale 8, except in 40s, rain or sleet, good, occasionally poor.